Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Steve Goldstein. I'm Lauren Gilger. Thank you for tuning in this morning. Coming up on the show, aid workers hoping to house migrant families may finally have a solution from a Phoenix school district, and the view from our neighbor to the south on the so-called Remain in Mexico policy being carried out by the Trump administration.
If you haven't encountered road construction in Phoenix lately, get ready, because you likely will. The City Council recently approved an accelerated pavement maintenance program for the next 5 years. KJZZ's Christina Estes joins me now to talk about the cost, the to-do list, and even how light rail factors into it. Christina, let's start with some of these key numbers. The city has said this program will triple the number of street miles in its pavement maintenance program. Can you break that down for us?
Sure. On average, Phoenix paves 16 major street miles per year. This program will boost that to about 50 per year for a total of 250 major street miles.
Okay, so when I hear repaving, does that mean tearing up the whole road?
Well, that's how you and I would describe it, right? Technically, it involves removing the top layer of asphalt and then applying a new layer of pavement. In addition to those 250 repaved major street miles, Phoenix has another 200 street miles, and those can be major streets, minor streets, little side roads. They will get other maintenance like ceiling cracks.
So what is this going to cost, and how is it going to be covered?
The short answer is $450 million covered through the Arizona Highway User Revenue Funds and a voter-approved sales tax to fund transportation projects.
All right, you know the short answer is not enough, so what's the longer answer?
Well, the city is borrowing $200 million to get the work done as soon as possible. Paying off the debt over 20 years will cost Phoenix between $250 and $300 million, so that $200 million price tag is really more like $450 or $500.
But this is a spending program that got unanimous support, which sounds pretty unusual, right?
Yes. Before voting, Councilman Sal DeCicio said residents deserve all the credit.
And this shows you what happens when the public gets engaged and they start saying enough's enough. Then you start seeing politicians actually take movement and take steps to try to get something done. It doesn't happen until then. It's unfortunate, but this should have been addressed years ago.
DeCicio has really welcomed and encouraged people to voice their concerns about street conditions, and he's not the only council member to hear complaints. Over the last year or so, I've heard several council members say streets are among the top, sometimes the very top issue for their constituents.
Well, okay, how do we measure how bad the streets are in Phoenix?
There's a measurement the industry uses called a pavement condition index, or PCI. It's measured on a scale of 0 to 100, with 100 being the best. To be considered in good condition, a street must have a minimum PCI of 70. In Phoenix, only about 30% of roads are considered good or excellent. That means 70% of streets are considered fair, poor, or very poor. That's more than 4,800 miles of streets.
Wow. Any idea what it would cost to improve those 4,800 miles?
The Street Transportation Department crunched numbers and said to get all the streets in good condition would cost $1.6 billion. Not surprisingly, the council voted for the cheaper option. While they think most people will be happy to hear streets are getting more attention, the city is aware that no one likes getting stuck because of road work, so they're really focused on messaging. You may come across signs that say, "Your voter-approved transportation tax dollars at work," and even some signs with more creative messages.
Okay, like what?
Well, one has a Game of Thrones reference, which I totally don't get, so I don't even know if I'm saying it right. It's "Forget winter, paving is coming." You get that?
Well, there was some big promotional campaign, yeah, where winter is coming, and not having watched it myself, I guess winter must have come because it shows off the air.
Well, there's also a Star Wars reference, which I did get, a sign that says, "This is no Jedi mind trick. This is the new pavement you are looking for." Sounds like you like that one.
Well, I do. And I'm also wondering, this is supposed to take away people getting angry on the road so they don't take out their lightsaber probably, right?
Yeah. Yes. So, yeah. Well, someone really liked that Star Wars reference because they swiped it off a street in Ahwatukee.
Okay, so if anyone sees that, they should contact the city, right?
Definitely. But on a more serious note, the messaging campaign is especially important over the next 8 weeks.
Oh, okay. Why is that?
In late August, voters will decide whether to kill future light rail extensions. Many of the people behind the ballot initiative want to see more money spent on streets and other projects. The mayor and the majority of the council support light rail and realize next month's election is critical. They'll be reminding voters that the city is listening to their concerns and spending money on streets, too.
So if someone wants to find out if street projects are planned around their neighborhood or business, how can they do that?
The city's Street Transportation Department's website has an interactive dashboard where you can check out current and planned projects. You can search by council districts and addresses. We'll have that link on our website, kjzz.org, later today.
And that is KJZZ's Christina Estes, always making our road smoother. Christina, thank you.
You're welcome, Steve.
A dozen wildfires are burning this morning throughout the state of Arizona. The Southwest Fire Coordination Center reports most are small, between a few hundred and a few thousand acres. A total of 30 wildfires were started over the July 4th holiday weekend. One of the most turbulent was Anthem, as thousands headed out of town on Wednesday. Traffic was stopped in both directions. Tiffany Davila with the Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management says firefighters had their hands full this holiday weekend.
It was a very busy weekend for firefighters across the state. At one point, we had not only the state resources, but BLM and all of our federal partners with the Forest Service responding to fires across the state.
Davila says the quick responses by fire crews kept most wildfires to a minimum. She also credits the Arizona Department of Transportation for helping get the word out about fire danger. The agency ran two signs that warn people about parking over dried grass or having tow chains drag on the highway.
ADOT is excellent. They're one of our state partners. They're great. When we ask them for help, when we ask them for messaging, they're more than willing to help us out, especially on long holiday weekends. They did it for us during Memorial Day weekend, obviously again on July 4th. Ironically, we did have a few fires that were started because of people pulling off into the tall grasses. So it's a good reminder to people that the undercarriage of your car does get hot. The catalytic converter gets hot. We've had roadside fires from tire blowouts. A majority of our roadside fires are dragging chains or some kind of vehicle into the grass or a vehicle started fire.
Davila says it's important for motorists to physically check their vehicles to make sure their tires have the correct air pressure and that nothing is dragging on the road.
Arizona's three public universities have had to look for alternative funding methods over the past decade, as one of the effects of the Great Recession was a significant reduction in money from the state. Those have included tuition increases and implementation of certain fees. ASU, for one, has also turned to entering into leases for land it owns. That has become a point of contention for Attorney General Mark Brnovich, who has sued to challenge that power of the state universities and the Board of Regents. Last week, a state judge dismissed all but one aspect of Brnovich's challenge, but the Attorney General may continue to pursue that. Earlier, I spoke with Regent Ron Schutman about a number of issues involving the universities. He just finished his tenure as chair of the board. We began by talking about the Achieve 60 AZ goal of having 60% of adults in Arizona with a degree in higher education by 2030. I asked Schutman about the progress he's seen and whether the goal is possibly too ambitious.
The goal is a very aggressive goal, and whether we make it or fall short, the effort to get us there and the progress being made is, I think, essential for the future of our state. The move toward automation, artificial intelligence, and is changing jobs rapidly before our eyes. So it's going to require training for Arizona's young people in particular and others in our society to be equipped to take on the new jobs that are emerging while the old-style jobs disappear. So I think that's a challenge for the state. The Achieve 60 goal is a great one because we're encouraging everyone to do training beyond high school, whether it's a certification, a community college degree, a four-year or higher degree. We believe that ongoing education really is the key to the future for our state.
There's the concern about, does Arizona have enough good teachers based on what they've been paid recently? And, of course, the Arizona Teachers Academy is a goal toward getting better at that and not having as many teacher openings and, frankly, giving people a reason to stay in Arizona as teachers. What do you think about the progress there, including the fact that lawmakers actually expanded some funding recently for the Teachers Academy?
I am an enormous fan of the Teachers Academy. I know from my life's experience that a quality teacher in the classroom makes all the difference for every student. If we could put a high-quality teacher in every Arizona classroom, a lot of our other challenges would disappear. So I'm a huge fan. I'm very grateful to the leadership of the governor and to the legislature for allocating the $15 million. It is allowing us to grow the program, and we're growing that program with highly qualified teachers prepared in our three universities, as well as our community colleges, to step into these classrooms and be able to provide the kind of instruction that inspires our youth.
And it sounds like a pretty clear way for the mission of the universities to match up with the mission of K-12.
It's become clear to me that as a board in particular, we can't be insulated and look only at higher ed. Our partnerships with community colleges, with K-12, and really with the families of Arizona are enormously important. Getting the message down to the people of Arizona that their youngster, no matter what their financial condition might be, can go to college in Arizona. If they'll take the courses that are required for entry and get a B or better average, we will find a way to get them in school.
We saw considerable tuition increases. That has leveled off. We've also seen an increase in fees. Are we in a situation right now where this is sort of a new normal, where we're not in a situation where state funding is going to be readily available in the same way? So tougher decisions have to be made. Do you feel like where we're at now has reached a level playing field to some extent, because there has been some planning and some progress over the past few years? And if more money comes from the state, that would be a bonus.
We're at a relatively stable time, and it is one that we are dealing with. The real need for additional dollars comes down to a single word, and that's access, to allow more Arizona young people to come into college and complete school. We have a problem with college going in Arizona. Our rate of youngsters going to school out of high school is 20% below the nation. We have to turn that around if we're going to be the kind of state that we hope to be. So the resources really will help us do that. We think about two things in particular. Are we delivering the best education possible? And are we delivering that at the lowest possible cost?
Recessions are inevitable. Do you think the state and its education system and university funding is at a place that is stable enough to withstand a quote-unquote regular recession?
The governor's move to put $1 billion in a rainy day fund should hopefully serve as a damper to a coming recession. I do believe we still, as a state, must invest more money in education. I can't think of a single investment a state could make that would chart its course forward better than that. And it's not just about the money. It's about ensuring that those teachers that are coming through the Teachers Academy are adequately paid, that we have quality leaders in those school districts and in those schools at the principal and superintendent level, and that the schools have the equipment and the support that they need in terms of counselors, et cetera, to ensure that more of our children go further down the education pipeline. So the answer is, yes, we will do whatever we need to do to survive the economy, whichever direction it turns. But my hope would be that we would come to a realization that additional funding in a planned way would be very helpful for the state's future.
Ron Schupman is a member of the Arizona Board of Regents and recently completed a term as board chair. In Mexico, the country is receiving a rapidly growing number of people who applied for asylum in the U.S. and were sent to wait out their hearing in Mexico. For the most part, these are migrants from Central America, and a few are choosing to return to their country of origin. For more on that, we have Jorge Valencia on the line from KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau. Jorge, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
So explain for us why the U.S. is sending asylum applicants to Mexico, and how many people are we talking about here?
Yeah, this is a practice that the Department of Homeland Security started implementing just a few months ago, and it's controversial on both sides of the border. They call it Remain in Mexico. And what DHS is doing is that they get people who arrive by land to the U.S., they apply for asylum, most of them from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. They receive the asylum application, and then they send them back to the last country where they were, which is Mexico. And in terms of numbers, the most recent figures that we've gotten from Mexican immigration officials is almost 17,000, which doesn't, I mean, you know, when you compare that to the number of people who are trying to enter the U.S. to the border, you know, legally, that's not a lot. But this is a number that we're seeing growing rapidly, and that is probably going to grow exponentially at least for the rest of this year.
Okay, so what happens to people when they get sent to Mexico?
Well, a handful, about 70, actually chose to go back to their countries of origin. They told immigration officials here that they would like to go back. So a handful are choosing to go back. This is about 70. It's not a big figure, but it is kind of a big deal that they went to the U.S., all the way to the U.S., they asked for asylum, and now they're asking to get sent back. This morning, Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he's really trying to go out of his way to say that they're giving humane treatment to migrants. And so he said that about 330 people have gotten jobs in factories along the border. But this is still a pretty small number when you add all those and you compare that to the 17,000 people who and counting who are being returned to Mexico.
And all right, finally, even those jobs can be short term. So is there any way of telling what can happen to these asylum applicants in the mid to long term?
Well, at the very least, I mean, in the immediate, we know that they're joining the masses, thousands of people who are waiting in Mexico to just to petition for asylum to the U.S., along with the many people who have gotten there over the years and have given up. And the reason why I keep on saying that this is a number that's going to grow exponentially is because the U.S. has sent people back through three ports of entry in California and in Texas. But authorities have already said that they're going to expand this to other ports of entry, to many more, including in Nogales, Arizona, onto Nogales, Sonora. So at the very least, this is a number that's going to keep growing. And there are many questions that we're actually trying to answer, primarily if these people are in Mexico and they're petitioning for asylum in the U.S. and they're waiting for the case to be heard out, how are they going to have access to an attorney in the U.S.? So I know there are some civil rights groups in the U.S. that are challenging this. So it seems that perhaps this controversial issue, we might see a resolution to it, to this Remain in Mexico practice through the courts.
Right. But still uncertainty remains at this point. That's KJZZ's Jorge Valencia from Mexico City. Jorge, thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve.
And now let's turn to the ongoing struggle to house the migrants who are being released in the valley every day by immigration officials. The stream of migrants, many of them families, who are coming to the U.S. to seek asylum continues to put pressure on aid groups who offer them housing and care after they are released by ICE. Almost 4 months ago, local aid groups called on governments to provide a facility to help house these families. None stepped forward. But now a centralized overnight shelter could open as soon as this week. And we're joined now by KJZZ's Matthew Casey with our Fronteras desk with more. Good morning, Matt.
Hey, Lauren.
So I understand these nonprofit aid groups found a school district that agreed to let a shuttered school be used as a transition shelter. Which district stepped forward?
It's the Phoenix Elementary School District number 1. They're letting a coalition of aid groups led by the International Rescue Committee use Anott School as a shelter. The building is near the Greyhound bus station and near the airport, and it closed to students in 2007. The district has been paying about $95,000 a year to maintain it.
Can you tell us more about the need for a temporary shelter?
Well, one of the coalition's major points at a recent public hearing on the whole shelter plan was that the current system, built ad hoc style since last fall, as you'll remember, is stressed to the max. So there's been increased talk of this strain growing since it started to get hot. You know, some volunteers left town for the summer. The cost to host migrants went up because people need air conditioning, right? So For months, people have been saying over and over they need an overnight shelter. I've heard it described by a social services executive as an obvious professional response to what's happening.
So how has the government response been to releasing migrant families into Metro Phoenix compared to cities elsewhere?
Well, I just think it's really interesting that a school district is the government entity that has agreed to step in here, because local aid groups have sought help from just about every level above a school board. So they went to the feds, our senators, our congressional reps, the state and cities. That they have gotten no help sets the valley apart from places like San Antonio, Albuquerque, Tucson, and San Diego, where local government has stepped in.
Okay, so what's next for this then, Matt?
Well, the building has to make city code first, and first and foremost, it has to be safe. That's expected to happen this week, and I'm told they could start taking migrant families in at that point. The coalition would be taking a risk by opening the shelter before the middle of next week, though. That's because someone could appeal the city's recent zoning decision that let the whole plan go forward. A neighborhood group has said it will challenge this. It's unclear if they actually have yet, but the window for them to do that, again, isn't until next week. If there is an appeal and things get delayed, attorney Paul Gilbert, who represents the IRC's coalition, tells me he's confident the original decision will be upheld.
All right, that's KJZZ's Matthew Casey. Matt, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Lauren.
And now let's turn to international news from our colleagues at the BBC. I'm joined this morning by Rich Preston from London. And Rich, we begin with an economic story. There's an upcoming event focused on what's been called the silver economy. What's that?
Well, Lauren, this is a forum being held in Finland this week. It gets underway tomorrow, and it's all to do with the economy around older generations. Now, Finland's got a vested interest in this because, like many countries, it has an ageing population. In fact, at the moment, in Europe as a whole, there are around 3 people of working age to every person over the age of 65. But in 50 years, there will only be 2 people of working age for every person of retirement age. So addressing how we cater for ageing populations is of global interest.
So what's going to be discussed at this conference?
Well, business mainly, like how to better attract older people to your company and keep them there. And this isn't just about the potentially obvious, like pharmaceutical companies. There's also firms there from the travel, home, technology, financial service sectors, and so on. Even the president of the Federal Reserve of Kansas City will be in Finland for this event this week. Now, the idea is that these are all parts of the economy that may have taken the needs of older customers into account previously, but never really focused on what they want. And as populations around the world age, they'll become a much more significant consumer base for a huge number of businesses.
And on Thursday this week, Rich, the French Senate votes on a possible tax on tech firms. What's this about?
Well, like many European countries, France thinks it's missing out on taxes because the big tech companies have become so good at managing where they pay tax. Now, a prime example for you, if you are in France and you buy something from Apple's iTunes store there, although the sales happened in France, that's where you press the button, for tax purposes, Apple will say that the transaction happened in another country where they pay much lower taxes. It's commonly Ireland. Now, many big tech companies have put their European headquarters in the Republic of Ireland, where they've been offered significantly lower tax rates. So France wants to put a stop to this, wants to introduce a law to change this, and if it passes, it'll be the first country to do so.
So what exactly does France want to do then?
Well, it says the tax should be collected where the sale takes place, not where the sale is processed. So the French government wants to introduce a 3% tax on the cost of transactions taking place online, such as purchases from Apple's iTunes. This is going to hit companies like Google, Amazon, Facebook, and of course Apple. They're going to be affected with an estimated cost of around 500 million euros. That's $560 million. Now, naturally, the tech companies are not happy about this, and they say it's going to drive up prices for everyone. But the US government's not happy either, including the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin. Officials have said this is a deliberate attempt to harm US companies.
And finally, Rich, around the globe to New Zealand, which begins buying back semi-automatic weapons on Saturday that the government there recently banned. How is this going to work?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one, especially for your listeners there in Arizona. Semi-automatic weapons were banned in New Zealand following the killing of 51 people at a mosque and Islamic Center in Christchurch back in March. I'm sure you remember that story, Lauren. Now, this new law covers military-style semi-automatic weapons and parts that can be used to assemble prohibited firearms. Now, the government set aside $136 million to compensate owners up to 95% of the original price of their weapons. Police in New Zealand estimate there are around 1.2 million legal firearms owned by civilians in the country. Now, that may not sound like a lot to you in the US, but of course, New Zealand is a much smaller country, and that actually equates to one weapon for every four people. This buyback scheme lasts 6 months, so people have until mid-December to return their weapons. And it's worth adding, this scheme does have widespread support. The events themselves are heavily policed, and there's even a stamping machine that will smash the workings of the gun then and there on site to make them instantly unusable.
But we've seen some media reports here in the US that things aren't exactly going to plan.
Yes, there have been a few problems. Some gun owners have said they're not getting enough money for their weapons. I'm sure you can understand their feelings about that. And there's concern about turnout and simply whether all of these newly illegal guns will be handed in. The government says they've already had 1,000 people turn in their weapons voluntarily and another 8,000 complete online forms for this amnesty. There are also fears, particularly among the rural and hunting communities, that the change in law might inspire a further clampdown on firearms in years to come. Nevertheless, New Zealand's gun buyback begins this weekend.
All right, that's the BBC's Rich Preston joining us from London. Rich, thanks so much.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks for listening to the show on this Monday morning in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Still to come, we'll find out why it's harder for young people to find jobs. And stay tuned. Coming up this morning at 10, we'll bring you the takeaway.
How can you get quality health care when you don't understand what the doctor is telling you? That's the question at the center of federal regulations that require some health care organizations to provide patients who don't speak English with free translation services. But now Kaiser Health News reports the Trump administration wants to ease those regulations. The move would also get rid of the requirement that directions be given to patients on how they can report on discrimination they may experience in the healthcare system. So we wanted to understand how translation and healthcare works. And for that, I sat down with Aliria Munoz-Rascon with the Edson College of Nursing and Health Innovation at ASU.
I have worked as a nurse in a hospital setting, and my role often was taking care of Spanish-speaking patients. So a lot of times in the hospital, we would get patients with a lot of different language barriers. And when I worked as charge nurse, for instance, in an oncology unit, I would go through the list of patients and we would actually mark, okay, this patient is Spanish-speaking only. This patient is Arabic-speaking only. And I would match up nurses that I'm like, oh, we have a nurse today that speaks Arabic. Looks like she's taking care of that patient today. And I would get a lot of the Spanish-speaking patients.
So it sounds like when you're working in a hospital setting, you're sort of just filling where you can. Mm-hmm. But there are systems in place to interpret for patients if that doesn't exist, if there doesn't happen to be an Arabic-speaking or a Spanish-speaking nurse on staff that day, right? What are those?
Sure. So in hospital systems throughout Arizona, obviously it's required to have interpreter services for limited English proficiency patients. So most large hospital systems here will have an interpreter in-house, typically of a common non-English language, which is Spanish here in Arizona. Even some of the larger hospitals will have two, maybe three interpreters in-house available at those really busy peak hours. However, that doesn't always meet everybody's needs simultaneously. If you only have one person with a pager or a phone that's available, then you need other resources. So a lot of hospitals will have remote interpreting services, so sometimes video remote interpreting services. What's really popular are dual handset remote interpreting services, which were these blue phones. We'd always call them the blue phones, and they would have two handsets. And so the nurse, for instance, if she had a Cantonese-speaking patient, would bring the phone into the room, pick up one side of the handset and say, okay, I'm looking for a Cantonese interpreter. And through that service, they would find a Cantonese interpreter remotely. The patient would pick up the other side, and you have this three-way conversation where the patient is expressing their needs and their concerns to the nurse, and the nurse is able to communicate back.
Yeah, give us a sense of how much of a difference it can make to be able to be there and translate for somebody. Obviously, like, you need to know what's going on when you're at a hospital with your own health, but have you seen situations, have you been in situations where it really, you think, could have turned out differently if you hadn't been there to do that translation?
Well, I mean, when I think about that, I think about what it's like to be a patient in a hospital, for instance. It's already really stressful. It's scary. It's confusing even if you speak English. And so when I would get assigned patients who are Spanish speaking and I walked in their room and I introduced myself in Spanish, I would just see this like wash over of relief in their face that, oh my gosh, I can finally talk openly with this person and we don't have to always wait for that blue phone or we don't always have to wait for an interpreter. So I've felt like a lot of times not only is the communication more fluid, but patients feel a little bit more relaxed and they might tell you more because they know you can just listen to them all the time versus, well, I'm not going to say anything. I don't have an interpreter available.
It's nuanced.
It is.
And that would, I'm sure, have impacts on their health outcomes, right?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of times patients who are limited English proficiency, they may not be familiar with this healthcare system. They may not be familiar with the resources available. And sometimes they don't want to be a burden either because they already feel like they might be more challenging to take care of. This isn't always the case, but sometimes patients have said, oh, no, it's okay. But in certain cases, I've had patients who, because I speak Spanish and because I'm taking care of them, they'll say, I wasn't going to say anything, but, you know, my back has really been hurting. Or I wasn't going to say anything, but my right leg, it feels really, really hot right now. Mm. And those subtle things, especially as a nurse, our assessment skills are paramount. And so our ability to really communicate with a patient fluidly is critical in being able to identify some of those early signs of complications or even, you know, problems that could be happening.
So the Trump administration is attempting to ease, not get rid of, but ease regulations for some healthcare organizations to provide these patients with a written notice of free translation services. And this is particularly when it comes to how patients can report discrimination. So first, I want to ask you, how common is it that patients, especially non-English speaking patients, will experience discrimination in this realm?
So discrimination's happening. Patients are reporting that they experience discrimination in the healthcare setting. And right now, the recent research is saying that it's a little more insidious. It's a little more unconscious bias that we're seeing. So it may not be as easy to detect or to see from an untrained eye, but it's happening. And there are health disparities happening in the United States. For instance, certain minority ethnic groups are experiencing chronic diseases more than non-Hispanic whites. They're experiencing not just the disease itself, but the complications or dying from that disease more than non-Hispanic whites. Mm-hmm. And now the research is saying that these health disparities that are happening could very well be linked to discrimination itself. Mm. And so when a patient is experiencing discrimination and they've shown that when a patient reports feeling discriminated against, there's a positive correlation between those experiences and depression, those experiences and anxiety. And not just that kind of logical connection of it must be stressful to feel discriminated against, but there's also a link between feeling discriminated against and reporting feeling discriminated against and hypertension and cancer and cardiovascular disease. So it's not just mental health, it's physical health as well.
And there's a link there, obviously.
Exactly.
So you talked a lot about, you know, what the importance of translation is, and I think a lot of that makes a lot of sense and is clear, but is it important, do you think, that it is required?
So I go back to nursing philosophy and nursing practice. So when I teach my students, we say, you are going to provide the highest quality care and the most evidence-based care that you can. And if we are keeping information from patients or even keeping information about information that's available to them, that's not providing the highest quality care. We're servants to our community. And I think that if we are truly going to be serving the community, we need to share with them the resources that are available. Because like I was saying, some of these patients who have limited English proficiency may already feel like a burden. They may already be hesitant to ask for more services. And so if we don't tell them those services are available, how can we ensure that they'll request them?
All right. Aliria Munoz-Rescon is a clinical assistant professor in the Edson College of Nursing and Health Innovation at ASU. Aliria, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. The Democratic presidential candidates have faced off in their first pair of debates, and polls that came soon after still show former Vice President Joe Biden leading the pack. But others, in particular California Senator Kamala Harris, made some strides. In a column for the Arizona Republic, John Gabriel asserts the Democrats actually didn't perform especially well and are making things easier for President Trump. Phil Boas, editorial director of the Arizona Republic, is with me for his weekly appearance to talk about Gabriel's column and the Democratic hopes to win the presidency in 2020. Phil, let's begin with the premise of this column. What is John saying about the Democratic debate performance?
Well, John is basically saying what a lot of people are saying, and that is it only took the first few debates for the Democrats to drive the train off the rails, which they did because they apparently have decided to go crazy in the era of Donald Trump and an overreaction that is going to be problematic for them in the future when we get to a general election.
Well, we have to, of course, the general election's a long time away. And I was, in reading John's column, my first thought was, it's early in the game. So, you know, we often see what some people might call pandering. Others will say playing to the base. We usually see that early in the campaign. Was there something, a certain issue that John or even you were really frustrated by when it comes to this?
Well, I just imagine the ad. Okay, imagine the Republican ad. Let's say Kamala Harris is the nominee for the Democratic Party. And the Republican ad comes on and it says, in the Democratic primary debate, every candidate said they wanted you to pay for free health care for illegal immigrants. And it's panning across all these candidates with their hands raised. And then it says every candidate, and it zooms in on Kamala Harris, hand raised. That's what you're going to be looking at in the general election. So even if this is early, it's going to have impact because they have gone very far to the left in a lot of areas.
The general polls indicate that Joe Biden still has the advantage, probably in part because of name recognition. President Obama left office with pretty good approval ratings, so there's that. How much do you think that plays into it, to try to stand out and be different from the front runner?
Right. Well, they're appealing to the base, obviously, and they're appealing to the people who are going to get out and really work for the candidates. And those are ideologues. They're idealistic people who really believe in Democratic Party politics and want to see progressivism spread across the country. Unfortunately, those aren't going to be the people who vote in the end. And so if you go too far to the left, you, as I said earlier, create problems for yourself. And no doubt that's what they're doing. They're trying to appeal to that part of the party that can elect people in the primary. So
certainly on a national level, Phil, both parties, they're less under control, certainly, than they used to be of party bosses, or however you want to phrase that, because no one expected Donald Trump to be the ultimate nominee for the Republicans. Are both parties so loose now that what happened in these first two debates, maybe 6 months, I get the ad part of it, it may just be forgotten to some extent.
Well, no, I think Trump had a lot to do with defining how these debates are coming out. Trump just shook the table so violently and made it look like anything is possible. All politics are possible. And so we're seeing a lot of ideas that have been on the back burner in Democratic politics coming to the fore. And the time may not be right for that. And they may find out. It should have been a clue to a lot of the Democrats that Biden was polling so well early on, because Biden is a moderate. He's moderate in temperament and in his politics. And that should tell you that there are a lot of Democratic votes out there that still want something a little more stable, and they don't want to go crazy new Green Deal left.
So John Gabriel's column ends in a kind of amusing way, except maybe to Democrats, that the only winner after those first two debates, do you see it that way? Because it's a very clever way, but I don't know if we can draw that conclusion so quickly.
Well, right. It's too early, but he's right. I think he's right. I think Trump won that debate. I mean, Trump is looking at, he has terrible poll numbers, but he's looking at some of his best from an ABC Washington Post poll just that came out the other day. So I think he has probably benefited from that as well. So the Democrats are going to have to get their game together, and they're going to have to temper their remarks and their politics and get real.
I ask you this as a Republican. We often say that, sure, you're a Republican, but you also want to see the best person to take on Donald Trump. Does that best person end up being someone who fits more the Democratic base or the person who can win?
I think the big misread here for a lot of the Democrats is that with Donald Trump, with somebody as extreme as he is in the way he practices politics, that the counterpoint, the counterweight is to go extreme. I don't think that's the counterweight to Donald Trump. I think the counterweight to Donald Trump is normal. It's anchored in common sense and to bring order back and get rid of chaos. I think that's what people are looking for if they're looking for an antidote to Trump.
Okay. Phil Boas, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Phil Boas is editorial director of the Arizona Republic.
Seventeen percent of Americans between the ages of 18 and 24 in big cities, including here in Phoenix, are unemployed. That's more than 2 million people. According to new research from the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, the majority of these young adults have a high school diploma or less. Our co-host Mark Brody spoke with Martha Ross more about this. To go into the numbers, she is a fellow at the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program.
What is it about this particular population that is leading so many of them to not be able to find work?
Yeah, we're looking at 18 to 24-year-olds, so folks who are really in a time of transition. You know, they're moving from being with family to independence, from school to work, and hopefully to financial independence. And young people in general have higher unemployment rates than older folks just by virtue of their age. They have less experience, they have smaller networks, they're generally not as competitive in the job market than people, say, 25 and over.
Is that an issue of schooling? Are they not properly trained? Is it a matter of they don't really know what they want to do?
Well, I think it depends. It depends on which group of young people you're talking about. And the higher unemployment rate stands for young people across the board. But there is this group that we were interested in this analysis that we did of folks with greater barriers. We wanted to see, you know, what was happening in this transitional period after the great conveyor belt of K through 12 education ends and you are on your own and you're facing either college choices or labor market choices. And what we know is that the labor market these days really favors those with a college degree or at least some post-secondary education. So if you are young and if you don't have much education beyond high school, then those doubly count against you in the labor market.
So within that population of 18 to 24-year-olds, were there other characteristics of those folks that maybe made them more or less likely to be able to find a job?
Well, this is kind of ironic, but whether or not you had prior work experience affects your ability to find work in the future. So it can feel like a cruel paradox. You know, how do you get experience when no one will hire you without experience? But that is one problem, that a lot of these folks just don't have any work experience. And the way people get work experience often is through connections, through family members or social networks. You know, they hear about an opening or they see a lot of people in their neighborhoods or in their family going to work. But if you're in an environment where there's not that many jobs around and there's not that many people working, then you're less likely to be able to find a job.
Let me ask you about what you found in Phoenix. You were able to break the numbers down into various cities across the country. And the number that really struck me was that almost a quarter of this population of 18 to 24-year-olds are out of work. That seems awfully high.
It is high. It's higher than the national average. Nationally, the figure is 16%.
So what is it about Phoenix that makes it such a difficult place for these 18 to 24-year-olds to find work?
Well, what I saw in the data is that there are a lot of folks who have left without a high school diploma. A third of all of the young adults without a job have less than a high school diploma.
Were there other characteristics of that 18 to 24-year-old population not working in Phoenix that stood out to you as maybe an opportunity for places for folks to try to figure out how to change that?
Well, there are always opportunities. So there are a number of programmatic changes that we could make. You can make it easier for people who have left high school without a diploma to, you know, to re-engage and make it, and also try to make it less like the program that they left from, which they probably didn't like. You know, we can do more job training that's closely linked to the labor market and that has, you know, guidance and mentoring for young people for whom, you know, the labor market may be completely foreign. There's lots of things we can do. I think what we need, one of the most important things we can do is start with a mindset that these young people have so much potential.
What is the impact on the overall economy of all of these people not working?
Well, it's a problem, and it kind of puts, it's a counterpoint to this story that we have that, you know, we have such a low unemployment rate. In fact, there are lots of people who at the beginning of their working lives are starting off on a bad footing, and it doesn't bode well for their long-term prospects. You know, if in this era of their lives, it's pretty important that they get connected to some kind of education. It doesn't have to be a degree. It can be training more related to specific occupations. It can be an apprenticeship. But what they need is to get some skills that are valued in the labor market so that they can get a foothold.
Do you get the sense that policymakers are interested in doing some of the things that, that you recommend doing to try to alleviate this problem?
Yes, I think they are interested, but I think they often find that it is complicated, which is true. And I think it's easy to get discouraged because you're looking at a decentralized landscape here. You can work with high schools, you can work with community colleges and four-year colleges, you can work with nonprofits and unions. And it takes a while in any one of those to get traction in initiatives. But yes, there is interest in this, and there are organizations doing great work everywhere.
That's Martha Ross, a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. Martha, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, Steve, I don't know if you recognize this song, but I have a question for you.
Yes.
Who rules the world?
Well, after yesterday, I suspect it is the U.S. women's national soccer team.
That is right. It was a spectacular game. The U.S. stared down the Netherlands in the Women's World Cup final yesterday in Lyon, France, and it was an intense match. Both teams played so defensively that for the first entire half of the game, no one scored a goal.
A lot of people were nervous about that.
Yes.
But the U.S. women ultimately showed the strength of their training and determination. They wore down the Netherlands. How many times have we used that phrase? They wore down the Netherlands with a final score of 2-0 to secure the World Cup, and the U.S. athletes rocketed their way to the finals, scoring win after win.
Now, did you know, Steve, there is an Arizona connection to the team?
I don't. I knew you played soccer, but I didn't know there was
soccer. That's not the connection.
Okay.
Two players on the U.S. team's roster are actually from Arizona. Julie Ertz, known to her fans as JJ, and Jessica McDonald. Both of these women were once part of the Tempe-based Sereno Soccer Club.
Wow, so we can all kind of share in their success.
Yes.
Now, this marks the team's fourth World Cup win. And of course, what we know, they're really outshining the men's soccer team. We'll see if they can step up.
Yeah, now it is time.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.